This podcast is a part of the Newhoff Media Podcast Network.
All right, we're back here on kind of a cloudy day, but it looks like things are going to shape up for Easter weekend. I know some of the schools, Milliken was out last week. I think saw one of our guys, one of our interns, like Merle Forsyth must be out this week. It's kind of all over the place, but Easter weekend is here. Feels very early, but we're ready to go. And so you got the Illini, you know, clearly, you know, capturing the imagination of everyone. You got the men's and women's tournament, which is everybody's, you know, worrying about their brackets and watching. I don't know how much work gets done this week or next. We'll see. But there are still, the world keeps spinning and things still keep happening. And it is hard for me to believe. I just got, last week I told you, Howard sent over a copy of the new book about 680 days in Ukraine. And we think about what we've done, or at least I do, over the last 680 days. What's your life look like? You know, you've got the flu and you've had great weeks and you've been on vacations and trips and you've had bad days at work and great days at work and you get to watch the football game. It's been a war for 680 days. And every man, woman, and child there, it's not some battle, you know, front out over here that doesn't impact everyone else. The horrors of things that I have learned via Howard, you know, about using children's toys to be attached to, you know, explosive devices. I mean, things that you just would like to think humanity's not capable of doing, yet we see over and over it is. So I'm very anxious to talk to our guest who's been on with us before, and a great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Laura Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science. You just got back Sunday?
Yep, Sunday from Ukraine.
All right. So what was the purpose of this trip and how long were you there?
So we got, me and some colleagues from Worcester Polytechnic Institute got a National Science Foundation grant to investigate human trafficking. And we're looking at human trafficking recruitment during war. So Ukraine kind of offers us an interesting look at the recruitment patterns, especially because Ukrainians are very technologically savvy. And so they use a lot of different apps. And so I basically went there to investigate and talk to local anti-trafficking advocates and kind of figure out what they're seeing on the ground. So what kind of dynamics with human trafficking have changed as a result of the war?
Okay, so let's first of all just give me the who, when, and what. You know, you were there for how long? 16 days?
Yeah, so I was there for 16 days. It would have been 17, but there was a Lufthansa strike, so.
Yeah. crazy how that stuff, you know, even that impacts a war. So you 16 days, you're on the ground where in Ukraine?
So I actually went to a bunch of different cities because there are different anti-trafficking NGOs located throughout the country. So I was based in Lviv and Kyiv. Kyiv's the capital. I went to Lutsk. I went to Ternopil, different Uzhhorod, different cities in western Ukraine, really on the border. And so those are the big anti-trafficking NGOs that see the majority of survivors of human trafficking.
Okay. Before we get into the specifics of the trafficking and what you found and the technology and the apps and all of that, just describe your experience as a human being in a country so torn apart by war for this long.
Yeah, I mean, so I lived in Ukraine when I was a graduate student, and so I was like, I got this. This will be fine. So basically, my train gets in at like 2, and it was about 2 hours until the first air raid alert. And I was like, what is that? And it sounds like a tornado siren.
Right.
And then somebody, a voice in Ukrainian, is yelling at you to take shelter. And so I'm in my apartment, and I'm like, what do I do? So I basically went and sat on the toilet.
Yeah.
And then there's an app on Telegram that you can actually look and see what bombs are coming at you and what is actually flying at you. So sometimes it's a ballistic missile. Sometimes it's a MiG flying around, because there are people that actually monitor where planes and drones take off from in Russia, and then they anticipate what is actually coming at you. So for me, that was the most frightening aspect, was you hear the alarm and then you go on the app and see, and if it's a ballistic missile, you should run.
Yeah.
If it's a MiG, sometimes they just fly around. They literally fly around Ukraine to like torment people. So,
and so you now think about this just, you know, year after year.
Yeah. I mean, I dealt with it for 2 weeks and I thought I would deal with it a lot better than I did. I had a lot of anxiety about things, especially when you're walking out on the street and you know that like a ballistic missile is coming towards you. That is frightening. So they send out these alerts, and then there's an app that you can actually look and see what oblast or what like region of Ukraine the alerts are happening towards. So they can actually see where the plane is going. So yeah, I had a lot of anxiety about it. We actually did have a couple hits when I was in Kyiv. We had two really large battles, the largest bombings that they've had since January, actually. And you could hear. So I woke up one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning to my building shaking, and I heard booms. And it was basically the anti-aircraft, the Patriot missiles that the United States thankfully has given Ukraine that protected us. So that was the one thing that was very getting woken up to a boom.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the metro, but the metro was closed down. And then I sat there and my building was shaking and my windows were shaking in central Kyiv.
It's amazing. What are the people like? I mean, what is the attitude? I know it's hard to encompass an entire country, but as you just, you know, visited normal day-to-day people, what's the mood?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised at how resilient they are. So, like, I would get the alert on my phone, and I'm like, okay, what do I do? Where should I go? Find the nearest shelter. And Ukrainians were much more relaxed because, again, they've dealt with this for 2 years.
Day in and day out.
Yeah, and so one thing I discovered during the, like, big bombings in Kyiv is that there's actually, like, an alert to hide, but then there's an alert where they know that things are coming, and then they know that it's a lot. Because basically, the 5 o'clock in the morning hit was 30 missiles coming at the same time, and they do that because then it's harder for them to shoot them down, right?
Right.
And so then you got an extra alert, and so the extra alert means run to the metro if you can. I was too far away from the metro. I lived
to get
blocks.
Underground.
Yeah, and so I basically just sheltered in place and went to my bathroom.
All right, it's amazing. Thank you for sharing the info. I just think we such a short attention spans, you know, as Americans, and a part of that's, you know, defense mechanisms in life, but part of it is it's just real easy to forget what people are going through when you don't have to see it every day.
Yeah. And I think for me, I was just surprised at how often they happen.
Yeah.
I mean, basically in a work day, you, especially in Kyiv, you're experiencing 2 to 3 times a day. And so, you know, you got to go to a shelter if it's particularly bad. And then they also do it at night to really kind of, and like, think about children living through that, getting woken up numerous times a night. That's just like psychologically taxing.
As hard as it is for most of us to understand war, you know, and the atrocities that happen in war, there are other people standing around waiting to take advantage of that in other ways, particularly where you have refugee situations or people fleeing a country. How much of that plays into the trafficking?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's why the, you know, situation in Ukraine is so dire and so important for us to research, because that is like the largest mobile population since World War II going into Europe. And so that's why we wanted to investigate it. But I think there's a lot of caveats of the crime that we were surprised that has happened. So,
okay, so what did you learn? And particularly, how did you use social media and technology and platforms to do your research?
Yeah, so we knew that there were a bunch. So basically, you know, the war started. We knew that there were a bunch of like refugee groups on different aspects of social media. So Telegram is the big social media. It's like the Facebook of Ukraine. So people started posting things like, I need a place to stay. I need a ride from here. I need to get over the border. What information do you have about that? And so we started seeing these, you know, posts coming, and then we started seeing people, you know, warning about human trafficking. And so we knew we wanted to start investigating that. And so I'm working with colleagues at Worcester Polytechnic, and they're engineers. And so they actually scraped the Telegram data. So we've scraped over 25,000 posts on Telegram, and we've been able to identify that about 15% of them are suspicious. So it could be someone who's posting, I have a free place to stay. But
so
only
somebody
18 to 24 year old women
being like from Romania or whatever, saying we welcome you in, could be bad actors that are just trying to either sex or labor, whatever kind of trafficking they're doing.
Yeah. And we can actually identify their IP address and identify a location, which has been interesting too. So we've been able to identify people who post a lot, like over thousands of posts. So we're trying to investigate, are these bots? Are these traffickers? What's the situation?
All right. And then how long, I mean, does this continue? Will there be like an actual published, here's what we learned, you know, what's the process look like?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, so I went, you know, to Ukraine and talked to people and asked them what they actually saw. And it's surprising to me because a lot of the media has really focused on the sex trafficking, but they've seen mostly labor trafficking. And now they're increasingly seeing labor trafficking within Ukraine. So because there were so many people that left, people actually come back too. And then if they were trafficked, you know, in Poland or something like that, they'll actually come back to Ukraine to receive assistance, which I thought was interesting. Interesting, because for them, it's easier to get assistance from someone in their own language. So,
yeah. Man, I can't even imagine. And here we are, and most Americans and maybe most of the world, I don't know how all that works, have just kind of moved on, and yet that just continues to be just a daily part of their life every single day.
I mean, we can do something as Americans. We can write to our congresspeople. You know, there are bills for funding of Ukraine for these Patriot missiles, for the anti-aircraft missiles that keep regular people in Ukraine safe every single day. Those supplies are running short because Congress hasn't acted on that. So if you feel like you want to, you know, support Ukraine and stand with Ukraine, you can always write to your representative and ask them to support Ukraine. And if they already are, thank them for doing that. Because really, those Patriot missiles, I've never really thought about missiles as much as I did on that trip, or being really thankful that the U.S. gave those Patriot missiles to Ukraine, because that was the only thing that kept us safe.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about the Human Trafficking Research Lab at Millikan University, just the overall, what it is that you guys do.
Yeah. So we do research on different human trafficking dynamics in Central Illinois.
What's the most surprising thing that people would find just here in Central Illinois that they didn't know that's an obvious thing to you?
I would say that labor trafficking is very prevalent, but people don't actually identify it. I think sex trafficking is just much more identifiable. So the fact that we have labor trafficking happening here in our community.
And what does that mean specifically?
So people being exploited for the purpose of labor. So it could be farm workers. It could be people begging, you know, on the side of the road. It could be people working in nail salons. So we've seen, you know, a lot of different investigations, and mostly it's like labor violations that are charged instead of actual human trafficking. But human trafficking happens within the labor, different types of labor industries. I mean, hotels are another big aspect of it. So
in those situations, can I ask, or is the range from bringing somebody to a place and then kind of giving them bad setup, underpaying them and giving them bad circumstances, all the way down to just full-fledged like captivity and slavery?
Yeah, so from forced servitude, from basically making people, like, you know, work for free, to indentured servitude, making people work off a debt, especially if it is a foreign-born individual.
I help you get here, and then now you work for me.
And then the debt is never paid off. Definitely like underpaying people or forcing people to do some sort of work that is exploitation.
So and then I would assume, tell me if I'm wrong, that because of the mood right now and the politics of, you know, immigrants and people who are here, there's even less likely a chance for them to reach out for help because of they're scared of whatever their status might be, or they're reluctant to, you know, so they're victims without any really sort of way of reaching out.
Yeah, I mean, immigration status is a huge thing that is used to keep people in a trafficking situation. So traffickers will say to them, well, if you go to the police, they're going to deport you, so you can't report this.
And they would rather, as sad as it is to say out loud, live under those conditions here than to go back to where they came from.
Yeah, and I think that's why we do see such a big self-identification with victims and survivors of trafficking. And usually it happens a very long time after their trafficking situation. They go to a talk or hear the news or something that says that, you know, and they recognize that as their exploitation situation. And so, and then they can finally get help. But yeah, it's interesting. We don't actually have a ton of identification happening during the trafficking.
It happens after.
Yeah, so, and usually by the people themselves. So.
What do you hope to accomplish? I mean, what can, you know, a group on the campus of Millikan University, working obviously with a lot of other organizations, what's the end goal? What's the hope? What would you like to have this accomplish?
I mean, so our adjudication research, I think, has been really surprising because, you know, in Macon County, there have been 10 crimes for human trafficking charged over the last like 20 years. And we found about 100 that could have been charged that had elements of trafficking. And so I think we're really hoping, we're thinking of making bench cards for judges to be able to recognize trafficking. We're trying to talk to prosecutors to be able to get them to attempt to charge trafficking instead of a lesser crime. Because again, when people look at the numbers, they say, oh, well, there's only 10, you know, happening in Macon County. It's not a problem here. But it is.
That was 10 that was identified and clearly identified and charged properly.
Yeah, in the Uniform Crime Report, which is like the big statistical database on crime in the U.S. Yeah, so I think we're hoping to do that. And because we sit on the Central Illinois Human Trafficking Task Force, we're on the ground with the police. We're talking to prosecutors and things like that. So they're always interested in hearing about the research. And I think having students there, showing them how to do the research and having them be advocates for, you know, charging for trafficking offenses is really good. You know, as an older person, I think they they wouldn't really listen to me, but having younger students on the task force, people are interested.
And clearly there's a larger call for this. I mean, you're getting funding directly from the Department of Justice. I mean, people are aware that we're not doing this the right way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the hope of the task force is really the Department of Justice funding is really to kind of bring these different entities together, because many times police don't always talk to victim service providers, prosecutors don't always talk to them. So it's a time and funding to be able to bring us all together to talk about these issues and how we can combat trafficking more effectively in our region.
The students that you work with, I feel like you could get very cynical about life, studying the worst of us, right? I mean, I really do. I mean, how do you, from a human level, how do you take a deep dive in the worst that humanity has to offer and still remain a positive human being?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, especially with the adjudication research, right? So we're looking at child pornography charges. We're looking at, different prostitution solicitation charges. And yeah, I mean, it's like a dark hole going down and seeing, especially when we coded the Macon County data, seeing it how often that happens in our region. Yeah, I mean, we have meetings where we talk about challenges and things like that. We take mental health days sometimes where you just need a break from the research. But yeah, I mean, it is taxing, but I think the students see it as valuable, especially because, we serve on this task force where people ask them questions about the research, so they know what they're doing is important.
All right. At the end of the day, that's got to be enough.
Yeah,
right?
Hopefully.
Well, I'm glad you're back safe. And what Laura got to see over there, everybody's waking up to again this morning, and on and on and on. And in this country, I guess you have a right to whatever your opinion is, but to play politics with these people's lives just seems grotesque. They live it every day, and they are tenacious people. And I got a chance a few weeks back, a month or so ago, there were some of their canine military officers here in Decatur training, and you could just see in their face, right? What they've lived through for the last couple of years. Yeah. And is amazing stuff. Dr. Laura Dean, thank you for sharing your information with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Really appreciate it. And glad you're back safe.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.